Okay, welcome back, podcast listeners, to episode 21 of Oklahoma Appeals, the podcast, and very exciting season finale of season one of the podcast. So after this episode, we will take a brief hiatus and return probably the first week or so of September. There may be a few mandates issue and published Court of Civil Appeals opinions that we'll catch you up on. But then, of course, once the Supreme Court returns to conference and issues their first opinions after the break, then we'll be sure to get an episode together to catch you up on those. But today, the agenda is to cover the published opinions from the Court of Civil Appeals for cases that mandate has issued in since our last update. So we've got, I think, 12 or so cases to cover. And just as a reminder, we don't cover them on the podcast or on the case alerts email until mandate issues. You know, they come out as published opinions, but they're always subject to going away if something happens that interrupts mandate, like a petition for cert granted or something along those lines. So we hold off until mandate issues and then we report on them. Speaking of case alerts, we do send out that case alert email every week or so with a brief summary of all of the new published opinions. So if you're not getting those, go to oklahomaappeals.com and be sure to sign up to receive that email in your inbox. And if you think you're signed up, but you're not seeing them, we do have some folks who say that they end up in their spam. Well, they're definitely not spam. So check your spam box.
Very important.
Yes. check your spam or junk mail folder and make sure that you add the case alerts to your safe sender list so those can get right on into your inbox so you don't miss any important information about newly published opinions. Hi, Jana.
Hi there.
You ready for the season finale?
I am. Okay. I do have a quick update on recent oral argument at the Court of Civil Appeals. So the Court of Civil Appeals held oral argument last week in a case, one of the Oklahoma City divisions. And so me and a friend went and watched, and it was interesting. The same panel has another oral argument set toward the end of July. So if anyone is interested, that is going to be on Thursday, July 29th at 10 o'clock a.m. So
there you
it
go.
Was a lively panel with a lot of questions. So,
okay, which panel was it?
It was Judge Pemberton, Judge Swinton, and Judge Bell.
All right. Well, do they all ask questions?
They all asked questions, several apiece of both sides.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. No one is taking the Justice Clarence Thomas approach to oral argument and never
not
asking
on the
a
Court
question.
Of Civil Appeals, at least okay. This panel. That's correct. So.
Okay. Right. Well, there you go. We had a. Did you get press credentials?
Or no
sit
press
in a special
credentials.
Spot
nope.
or anything?
No.
Well, maybe next time. Live correspondent. Jana Knott covering
that's right.
Your
yep.
Oklahoma
I mean, if there's
Court
a demand for it, I'll start live tweeting, but I'm not sure there is. So we'll see.
Did they live stream the oral argument?
I don't think so. I didn't see anything set up that indicated that they did.
So we're not making any progress on
at the Court of Civil Appeals in that regard.
Okay.
That's
well,
correct.
maybe we should submit a request prior to the next argument that they live stream that, and then we could let our listeners know mm-hmm. via probably the case alerts maybe that there's an opportunity to watch an oral argument from the comfort of your own office.
There you go. That's
but we'll see what we can
idea.
Do about that.
Good idea.
Okay, you start working your connections up there. Maybe you should just sit in there with your iPhone and like Facebook Live the oral argument.
Right. Yeah.
That would definitely be a first.
I think I won't do that.
Okay, well, I tried. Well, I think the first case is yours, is it not?
It is. We've got, I think we're going to start with 2021. Okay, CIVAP 14, Rhodes versus Hernandez. So this is an issue involving a protective order that was entered, and this comes from the District Court of Tulsa County. A protective order was entered, and that's what's on appeal, and it was assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals Division 4. So the underlying facts are that the plaintiff and defendant were co-workers, and plaintiff alleged that the defendant was physically assaulting and harassing him. And so he filed for a protective order under the Protection from Domestic Abuse Act. And on the form, he selected the box for harassment rather than stalking. And so both parties appear at the hearing. The defendant does not dispute the allegations made in the petition, and the lower court issued the protective order.
Yes, Your Honor. I was physically assaulting and harassing my coworker.
Well, he has a change of heart, if you can imagine why we're on appeal. 3 months later, he hires a lawyer, the defendant does, and comes in and files a petition to vacate the protective order, arguing that his constitutional due process rights were violated because the plaintiff checked the harassment box instead of the stalking box. The trial court denied the petition to vacate and the defendant appealed. So this comes up, and in an opinion from Judge Thornbrew, he recites that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And he basically says, I mean, the court holds that checking the wrong box on the form did not create any due process or jurisdictional issues. And he basically says, look, regardless of what box was checked, the underlying facts that were alleged could be considered stalking or harassment. And we are not going to require any kind of a heightened pleading standard in these types of cases, especially because most of the time, the folks that are filing these often are pro se, and there's just no need for a strict pleading requirement in a situation like this. So no abuse of discretion by the trial judge in issuing the protective order, and the cert petition was denied 8-0.
Shocking.
That's it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that the Supremes didn't have any interest in this one. Kind of surprised it was a published opinion, but My guess is that the defendant probably realized that he was going to suffer some prejudice in life. Mm-hmm. Because he had a protective order against him, either when he applied for a job or tried to buy a gun or something. And this came up on his background check, and then he had a change of heart, as you said. So, okay, very well. Next case, 2021 OK CIVAP 15, Penn Grand Management versus Home River Group. This is a forum selection dispute. So kind of a contract law thing. Comes up to the court from Oklahoma County and was assigned to Division 2 of the Court of Civil Appeals. This is a dispute between a property owner of an apartment complex in Oklahoma City and the management company, Home River, that the owner hired to manage the property. Home River and Penn Grand Management entered into a written property management agreement, which, you know, would cover Home River's management of the apartment complex for the owner. And then there was some construction that was undertaken on the property, the same apartment complex that was a subject of the property management agreement. And the owner asked Home River to manage the construction project on the apartment complex. Home River agreed and went about doing that. No written agreement regarding the construction management scope of the relationship between the parties. So written contract for property management, no written contract for construction management. And a dispute ensues. And the owner sues the management company, Home River, on a variety of claims, some related to property management, some related to construction management. Home River files a motion to dismiss and says, hey, owner, you know, we have this written property management agreement that has a choice of forum clause in it that says that if we have a fight, we're going to have that fight in state or federal court in Tennessee, where our offices are, not in Oklahoma City, where your apartment complex is. The trial court granted Home River's motion to dismiss all claims based on this choice of forum clause in the property management contract. So the owner, Penn Graham Management, appeals, and the Supreme Court signs this to Court of Civil Appeals, as I mentioned. And the Court of Civil Appeals says, well, this came up as an appeal of a motion to dismiss, but really the trial court considered exhibits and heard testimony. So it went way beyond the pleadings. And so we really should look at this as a summary judgment motion, not a motion to dismiss, even though that's what they called it. And the trial court, we're going to review it as a summary judgment motion. And so we're going to look at everything de novo, no difference. And they look at the property management agreement and they say, well, you know, the property management agreement that has the forum selection clause does not address construction management at all. And so if we're going to enforce a forum selection clause, we first have to determine, you know, which claims fall within the scope of that clause. And then we're not going to disturb the trial court's decision on that necessarily, unless there are some public interest factors at play that would cause us to ignore a forum selection clause. But we don't think that is at issue here at all. Rather, what we see is that there really is nothing in this forum selection clause or the language of the written property management agreement that indicates the parties intended the forum selection clause to apply to the construction management services that were being performed under a separate oral agreement between the parties. So they send this back to the trial court. They say the trial court was correct to uphold the forum selection clause with respect to the claims that fell within the scope of the property management agreement. But when it comes to the construction stuff, they should not have dismissed those claims because they were not subject to the forum selection clause. So affirmed in part, reversed in part, remanded back with those instructions. This is an opinion written by Judge Fisher. Judges Barnes and Rapp concur. Home River petitioned for cert, and that was denied. There was one dissent in the order denying cert, but back to the trial court they go.
Okay. Interesting.
At least with respect to the construction claims. I suppose if Penn Grand Management wants to pursue the claims related to the property management services, they're going to have to take those up in Tennessee.
Tennessee. Interesting. Not a ton of published case law on forum selection clauses, so this will be a good one to keep in your toolbox, I suppose.
Okay. Do you have a toolbox in your office before you print out opinions and file them away?
In your mental toolbox.
Okay, there we go. I could have been more articulate on the law that the Court of Civil Appeals kind of recites with respect to forum selection clauses. So let me try to, since you've now highlighted that there aren't many of these cases and, you know, we should have them in our toolbox, we make sure that you file it in the correct place in the toolbox. So the court says that when it comes to enforcing forum selection clauses, again, the important thing is to determine whether the claims fall within the scope of the clause. And that the court will not consider the party's private interest in selecting a forum for their disputes because they've already expressed and determined that in a contract between them. So it may be a terribly inconvenient place for one or both parties, but if one of the parties wants to enforce the forum selection clause in a written contract, then the convenience or, you know, the kind of a forum non-convenience type analysis is not undertaken because the parties have already
determined those.
They considered, they already were supposed to take that into consideration when they signed this contract that they most likely didn't read that had this form selection clause in it.
It's true.
And the only way around that is that a court may consider arguments of public interest factors. So while the party's private interest in convenience won't get them out of a validly entered into forum selection clause, if there are some public interest factors at play, then that could be a way for the court to avoid enforcing a forum selection clause. But there's nothing in the record in this case that suggests the need to consider any public interest factors. So they didn't engage in an analysis of that, just pointing out that, I guess, bottom line is courts in Oklahoma are going to enforce forum selection clauses if the parties have validly entered into them, with the only escape clause being a potential public policy argument if you had the right facts for that. So, okay, next case, Edwards versus Invest Trust, 2021 OK CIVAP 16. This is a dispute between a corporate trustee and some beneficiaries. The corporate trustee was asked to step aside in favor of a different trustee. And the provisions of the trust at issue gave the party asking them to step aside the power to remove and replace the trustee at any time. So no issue there. But Invest Trust says, well, the replacement trustee you selected is in Wyoming. And so really, by selecting a trustee in Wyoming, you're in effect changing the situs of the trust from Oklahoma to Wyoming. And, you know, we're not sure you can do that without approval of an Oklahoma court, because the trust doesn't give you the power to change the situs. Yes, we acknowledge the trust gives you the power to change the trustee, but we're troubled by the fact that your selected replacement trustee is in Wyoming. And we think the implications of that are that you're relocating the trust to Wyoming, and we would just feel better if you got an Oklahoma court to say that was okay. More about why the corporate trustee is being perhaps extra careful here later. There's some additional background that will come into this. Yes. Cliffhanger. So plaintiff who wants to change the trustee, you know, files action in Oklahoma County, and an agreed order is entered approving the appointment of the Wyoming-based trustee. So Invest Trust did not try to prevent the change. And in fact, they signed an agreed order. They just wanted a judicial blessing of this change of a situs of the trust to Wyoming. Then the plaintiff filed a motion seeking to deny Invest Trust the payment of their attorney's fees from the trust. Motion to deny fees. They were upset, obviously, that Invest Trust was requiring them to go through the trouble of getting the court's blessing for the change of trustee. And they didn't think that Invest Trust should be able to recover their attorney's fees incurred as a part of that process. The trial court denies the motion to deny. So basically grants Invest Trust counter motion for summary judgment approving payment of the fees from the trust. So trial court says, no, trustee is going to get their attorney's fees paid. Plaintiff appeals. And I don't remember if we had in the opinion the amount of the fees, but I don't think they were that material, especially would I tell you some more about this background in a moment. So it goes up to Court of Civil Appeals. It's assigned to Division 2, and they say, we're going to review de novo because this is review of a summary adjudication. And of course, you know, that means they're going to look at the facts in light most favorable to the non-moving party, but we're going to take a fresh look at it and not be bound by anything the trial court did. And they basically pretty succinctly say that the trustee was not being unreasonable and that there's no reason they shouldn't get their fees paid. So there you have it. That's kind of the long and short of that one. You know, the trustee was acting within the scope of their powers and duties as trustee to insist upon court approval of the change of situs of the trust. And furthermore, the express terms of the trust provide that the trustee is entitled to hire attorneys, etc. And also, statutorily, 60 OS 175.24A9 gives trustees the power to employ attorneys at the expense of the trust. So, affirmed.
Interesting. I guess my question I go back to is, I guess it's an order of the court, but I mean, an agreed order, that's, I don't understand. The court's not determining anything if the parties have agreed to it, but nevertheless.
Well, this, I was looking at the docket and I noticed that this case was companion case to a couple of others. So I did a little sleuthing at the other cases, and it appears that this is but one very minor chapter in a very long dispute between between this plaintiff and not only Invest Trust, but several other corporate trustees who have taken a shot at serving as trustee of what collectively is about $100 million or more in assets combined between two or three different trusts that have been litigated extensively over the last almost 40 years. So there are three or four trusts that resulted from the apparently significant fortune of Robert S. and Eloise Bowers. And they have a disabled grandson who is, I believe, the primary beneficiary of at least some of these trusts. And I don't really know and was unable to find, with a little bit of digging around, the source of this fortune or who the Bowers family is. But if you look at some of the other published opinions in this saga of litigation, it seems that about every large trust department in Oklahoma has been involved in some lawsuit surrounding this family's trust and several other very recognizable wealthy families in the area are also related in some way to this fortune. But I'm unable to figure out exactly who these folks were, where this money comes from, but I'm sure the lawyers involved.
Well, that makes a little bit more sense. In a vacuum, it seems a little bit odd to file a suit and then just submit an agreed order. But if there are other issues, then that makes more sense.
And clearly, the plaintiff is aggrieved and upset at a series of corporate trustees and sues them over what seemed to be a relatively small amount of attorney's fees, especially in context of a $100 million fortune. So There you have it. There's the rest of the story. Okay. So if you're interested, one of the other companion cases is number 118214. And that case is pending cert. There was a trial court decision that was reversed by the Court of Civil Appeals, and it's now pending cert. But so you can read more about the background of the trust, and you can perhaps pull some more threads if you want to unravel this mystery by starting there. Yeah. Or just Google the parties' names and you'll find a bunch of other cases to come up to. So anyway, there you go.
All right.
We've had some requests for more gossip on the show, so that kind of qualifies.
Yeah. I think that's right. I'm just thinking that. We'll try to give you some more juice here. So
we're no TMZ, but you know, we'll try to throw a few nuggets out there once in a while.
Yeah, our sleuthing capabilities are limited.
We don't have investigative reporters. So next case, also me. In re the Marriage of Mitchell, 2021 OK Civ App 17. This is a kind of a real estate / family law case coming up out of the District Court of Delaware County. Court of Civil Appeals Division 2 also was the author of this opinion. And parties were divorced in 2012, and in the decree, some language was entered regarding some real estate that the parties owned, and that apparently was subject to divorce division, subject to division in divorce, I guess is a better way to say that. But the decree said that the petitioner was awarded this property, but that the petitioner would not, without written approval of the respondent, enter into a contract to sell the property for less than $700,000. And should the property be sold, the respondent was to receive 50% of the profit on the sale up to a maximum of $150,000. So petitioner gets the property. Apparently, it was already listed for sale at the time that the decree was entered. And the decree says, it's yours, petitioner, but if you sell it, you can't sell it for less than $700,000. And when you do sell it, 50% of the profit up to $150,000 goes to the respondent. So we don't know what the...
Even though it couldn't be sold for less than
$700,000? Well, it's 50% of the profit, and we don't know what the cost basis of the property is.
So, okay, thank you.
When I first read that a couple of times, I was like... The math isn't making sense to me, but I don't know how much cost there was.
Could have had a mortgage.
Exactly.
I'm assuming it probably did.
So it was 7 acres adjacent to a mobile home park. So that's entered in 2012. And apparently 4 years later, without any kind of notice to the respondent or approval, the petitioner sold the property for $500,000. So less than the petitioner was supposed to be selling the property for. The respondent became aware of the sale after the fact and went to court and said, hey, petitioner should be ordered to deposit $150,000 into my attorney's firm trust account until we figure out what 50% of the profit was and did I get what I was entitled to under the divorce decree. And so the trial court entered a temporary restraining order prohibiting the petitioner from disposing of any of the funds from the sale and ordering her to immediately deposit $150,000 into the trust account of the respondent's attorney. Subsequently, the trial court found the petitioner guilty of indirect contempt for failing to comply with the divorce decree and awarded the respondent attorney's fees and costs in the amount of $7,200 and also interest on the $150,000, I guess going back to the time the property was sold. And that interest amounted to $17,000. And for reasons that aren't clear from the record, also ordered the file to be sealed. The petitioner appeals the contempt order and the order awarding attorney's fees. So that's how this is set up, coming up to the Court of Civil Appeals. The Court of Civil Appeals says this is basically a contempt proceeding. And when it comes to contempt proceedings, we don't look at questions of fact, but we will review questions of law de novo. So, getting to the appellant's complaints, she complains that the trial court disqualified her counsel, that the trial court excluded evidence, and allegedly improperly sealed the record. So, looking at those issues, the Court of Civil Appeals says it's totally unclear to us why the petitioner's attorney was disqualified, but the record is just devoid of anything we can review. So we're not going to speculate about the trial court's reasoning. So there's just a little reminder to trial attorneys. If it's not in the record, the appellate courts can't really review it. The Court of Civil Appeals said legal error may not be presumed from a silent record. And in fact, the opposite is true. The appellate court presumes the trial court did not err and absent a showing to the contrary. So I'm not going to disturb the trial court's disqualification of the petitioner's attorney for lack of any record to review. Court of Civil Appeals also says unclear from the record why the trial court entered an order sealing the record in this case. However, when it comes to sealing the record, there's nothing to show that the trial court complied to any degree with either the letter or the spirit of the Oklahoma Open Records Act. So Okay. In one case, when it comes to disqualifying the petitioner's attorney, since there's no record, we're not going to look at that. But when the sealed record, I guess the burden is different because we are going to reverse that because there's no record showing that sealing was.
Did they reverse it?
No, they did. They didn't reverse it, but they said that, there's no. There's nothing in the record to show us that the trial court complied whatsoever with the Open Record Act.
That's what you're saying.
And they kind of admonished the trial courts about overbroad sealing orders. Yeah. And which is a theme. We've seen that in a couple cases recently. But there's nothing in the record that indicates that the petitioner asked the trial court to correct this. So we're not, because you're just first complaining about it on appeal without giving the trial court an opportunity to correct the sealing of the record, then we're not going to intervene.
Okay. I see what you're saying now. So again, this issue too is, again, they're saying that you've pointed us to nothing in the record really that allows us to reverse this case. But yeah, they strongly urge the trial court to hear more assiduously to the Open Records Act letter and spirit in future cases.
Yes. There really isn't much in the opinion about the exclusion of evidence issue, so I can't tell you much about how the Court of Civil Appeals analyzed that. However, they did find that there was nothing wrong with the trial court's decision that the petitioner violated the divorce decree, and the record was sufficient to show that the indirect contempt was warranted. And the petitioner's claim of error by the trial court in awarding respondents attorney's fees is also without merit. There's nothing in the record to show that the petitioner presented these arguments to the trial court at all. So another issue, we're not going to take up an issue on appeal that you didn't even argue at the trial court. And furthermore, 43 OS Section 110 authorizes the court to award attorney's fees in divorce actions, which is what the underlying case here was a divorce decree, enforcement of a divorce decree. So overall, the outcome was affirmed and there was no petition for cert filed.
Okay, so what I'm going to take away from this one is the admonishment on the Open Records Act. That to me appears to be the most important thing coming from here. What about the divorce decree? Do we know if that was filed in the county records where this property was? I'm just wondering why it wasn't flagged before the sale went
good
through.
Good question. I do not know if the opinion addresses that.
Mentions it. Okay. Well, I just think it's an interesting claim to file to hold the person in contempt for not following the divorce decree. Procedurally, that's sort of interesting to me. So,
well, I think it's not uncommon for divorce decrees to create title problems. So, you know, if you're trying to do something creative in a decree with respect to real estate, if you're not, you know, real comfortable with real estate title law, you're encouraged to run it by somebody who does some
reach
real estate
out to someone
law
who
to,
is.
To yes. get their two cents on how that's going to play out in practice. Because, yeah, anyway, enough said about that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to harp on that one. But anyways,
well, okay. You get to harp on the next one because it's your case. So harp away.
All right, then. Okay, 2021 OK Civ App 18. This is Bales versus State XREL Oklahoma Real Estate Appraiser Board. So this is not a party that we see too often in published appellate decisions, the Oklahoma Real Estate Appraiser Board. This case stems from two appraisers who are certified in Oklahoma. One of them was the supervisor for the other, and the supervisor in the process of, I don't know if he's younger, but the younger appraiser's application to become a certified appraiser did some things that the real estate appraiser board was not impressed with. So From what I can tell, it looks like the gentleman filed his application with the board to become a certified appraiser. And in that process, I believe they have to submit some of the work that they've done. They have so many hours that they have to complete before they can file this particular application. And so they submit all this documentation. And then during this training period, they do what they call fluffing up of the appraisals that the trainee had been working on so that they were in tip-top shape for the board's review of his application to become a certified appraiser. And the board, I guess, figures out that this has happened and disciplinary proceedings are instituted against both gentlemen. And so the board...
I guess what happened is that you're supposed to submit specimens of actual work product to
yes,
the board.
Yes.
And instead, they took some actual work product,
fluffed it up,
and submitted that. So you had one version of the unfluffed report that went to a client and another version of the fluffed report that went to the board.
Yes. So somehow the board ends up with both versions and they realize that they are not the same. And so they begin disciplinary proceedings against both the supervisor and the trainee. So the parties before the board enter into stipulation of facts where the supervisor and the trainee admit to fluffing up appraisals that he had worked on during his training period, but before they were provided to the board for its review. And they also, within the stipulation, apparently admit that these modifications were done to bolster the trainee's application for an appraiser's license. And the board finds that these acts were in violation of certain provisions within Title 59, which governs this area. And so they imposed discipline on the two appraisers, and it was suspension of both of their licenses for 30 days. And I believe they also popped them with some fees because of the work that the board had to do and getting legal fees and this and that. One interesting side note that the Court of Civil Appeals notes is that the board actually submitted a question to the Attorney General in this case on before it issued its disciplinary order. And so the question was related to what the board could do with regard to discipline. And the Attorney General issued an opinion and said that the statutes allow the board to censure, suspend, and revoke certificates pursuant to disciplinary proceedings provided in the Act, and that the board could require payment of fines and costs and the completion of educational programs. So the case goes up on appeal. The two appraisers who are disciplined file the appeal. And the first step in a situation like this in the appellate process is the district court. So it's an administrative, technically now that it's up to the Court of Civil Appeals, it's an administrative appeal. But first they had to go to the district court where the decision was affirmed. So now on appeal, the Court of Civil Appeals is operating under the Oklahoma Administrative Procedures Act with regard to the standard of review. And so the agency's order is going to be affirmed if the record contains substantial evidence in support of the facts upon which the decision is based. So here the court says, look, the stipulated facts and testimony before the board seem to form a basis of substantial evidence to support the board's decision in this case, that provision of the statute were violated. And we don't see anything here that indicates the board's decision was arbitrary and capricious or made outside of its discretion. So they say, we are not going to disturb the board's choice of discipline here, absent some manifest abuse of the agency's discretion. So this is affirmed. Judge Barnes authors the opinion, and the two appraisers initially sought cert review, but then dismissed their petition. So interesting case here. I, as an appellate lawyer, am always concerned about stipulated facts because difficult to deal with on the back end in an appeal. And I'll leave it at that for purposes of today's discussion. So
there you go. Yeah, no, sometimes tempting at the trial level to stipulate because it saves time and you don't have to bring witnesses in and all that. But appellate lawyers, not a fan of the stipulations.
Not a fan. Not a fan of stipulations.
All right. Well, next case, 2021 OK Civ App 19, Martin versus City of Tulsa. This is a Workers' Compensation Commission appeal. And also, it is based on a prior version of the applicable statute. So probably not worth a great deal of our time because the statute has been changed and a different result would ensue in this case under the new version of the statute. But nevertheless, we'll give it a go here. So this is an injured Tulsa firefighter. He has to miss some work because of his injury. And so he is entitled to some temporary disability payments. And also he is ultimately given a 28% impairment rating to his right wrist, which entitles him to just shy of $20,000 in partial permanent disability. So the city of Tulsa says, hey, we paid this firefighter about $13,500 in temporary disability in excess of what he would be entitled to under the statutory maximum. And we would like credit for that against this roughly $20,000 permanent disability award. And the reason that the firefighter received about $13,500 in excess of what he was entitled to under the statute for temporary disability was because of a collective bargaining agreement between Tulsa and the firefighters.
Seen this issue before, yes. Several times. So
the collective bargaining agreement negotiated on behalf of the firefighters in Tulsa says that you get full pay if you are away from work due to injury. And for firefighters, full pay is going to be more than the temporary disability that is authorized by statute. So then the issue becomes when the worker is given payment for permanent disability, does the payor get a credit for that excessive temporary disability? And in this case, they did.
Survey says
yes. Ding, ding, ding. The administrative law judge and the Workers' Compensation Commission all say, based on the statute in effect at the time of this injury, Tulsa gets to deduct from his partial permanent disability the amount that the firefighter was paid in wages under his collective bargaining agreement that were in excess of the statutory maximum amount for temporary disability award. The Court of Civil Appeals agrees and basically says the statute is the statute is the statute. And there's no argument in this case that the revision to the statute should be applied retroactively here. So affirmed. This is actually 3-0 at the Court of Civil Appeals. Presiding Judge Mitchell, the author of the opinion, and Vice Chief Judge Swinton, and Judge Gorey, who was sitting by designation on this panel, concurred. Petition for cert goes to the Supreme Court, and they deny 6-2, although Justices Gurich and Edmondson dissent in an 8-page written dissenting opinion. So a pretty lengthy dissent to a petition for cert. But as mentioned, 85A Oklahoma statute section 2014 section 89 was amended subsequent to this firefighter's injury to specifically prohibit deduction of any benefits on account of wages paid pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement. So he would have had a different result under the revised statute.
Do we know what the dissent the dissent was about in the denial of cert?
I invite all interest in that to read the written dissent in full.
That'd be a no.
I don't
folks.
Have any idea.
All right.
But I think this is an example of how the system's supposed to work, right? The court rules based on the statute as it is. And if the legislature does not like the result, then they have the power to change the statute. It's unfortunate for those who, you know, get a different result under the old language, but that's how the system works from the 30,000 foot view of things.
Okay.
Well, back to you, Jana.
On to the next. Wagner versus Office of the Sheriff of Custer County, 2021, OK Civ App 20. So in this case, a professor of journalism from Wisconsin sends a request for records to the sheriff's office in Custer County under the Oklahoma Open Records Act, and he's seeking incident or initial offense reports generated by the sheriff's office for a period of 2 days. And the professor requested that the records be delivered either by digital file or via email. And so the sheriff in Custer County finds the records, makes them available for inspection and copying in his office in Custer County, but refuses to deliver the records by email or digitally. So the professor sues the sheriff in the district court of Custer County, claiming a right to electronic delivery of the records under the Open Records Act. The sheriff moves for summary judgment, which the trial court grants, and the professor appeals. So this is coming up on a review of an order granting summary judgment to the sheriff, and it's assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals Division 1. Standard of review here is de novo. And in an opinion from Judge Mitchell, he takes a look at the language of the statute and says, you know, although the sheriff could have given the records to this professor electronically, the language of the statute does not require it. And because the sheriff has made the records available for copying and inspection, there was no violation of the Open Records Act here. And that's all the language of the statute that the language of the statute requires. So this is affirmed 3-0, and neither party sought cert review.
Which is interesting. I mean, if you care enough, if you're a professor in Wisconsin and you care enough to spend the money to try to make a point by suing over this issue, why do you not take it all the way?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
We should have reached out and asked. We should have asked this guy, what are you doing here? I mean, who knows, you know, what you've invested to bring this lawsuit, brief it on appeal. Well, I guess it went up from summary judgment. So
it did go up from summary judgment. So no additional appellate briefs, but I imagine that there was still some, you know, some matter of briefing on summary judgment. So
although I would have thought that they probably knew they were going to lose. I mean, the statute says what the statute says.
But also, you know, what I would think would be a somewhat important ruling for municipalities and other public bodies, that there's at least one published Court of Civil Appeals opinion out there that says that you do not have to provide records electronically.
For sure. But you know, again, why, if this guy cares enough about this issue, he's obviously doing this not because he's not been denied the records. He could have spent far less money to probably fly to Oklahoma City and drive out to Custer County
and got
his records, or certainly hired someone locally to go do that for him. So this is not about the records,
curious,
right?
Approach.
This is about a policy that he's trying to get changed or shed light on. And why stop on third base? I don't know. Maybe he
good
didn't
question.
Think he had the
it's a great question.
I mean, maybe he didn't think, or his counsel didn't think, they had the right facts to create, you know, Supreme Court precedent on this issue. This wasn't the one they wanted to get a definitive answer on. But interesting.
I'd be interested to know what the underlying records requests was for. It was 2 days of
I think
offense reports.
I think we've had some
incident or offense reports.
There was another published opinion this year that was an insurance issue, but it related to some abuse suffered by inmates in a county jail. Remember that case? And I think there's been a few of those cases. So I'm wondering if it's related to that.
Interesting.
That was a coverage issue, I think, about insurance coverage for the sheriff's department. There was that disqualification case. We're getting way down a rabbit hole, but there was also a disqualification case where the former insurance defense attorney had switched sides on the plaintiff, and that was a published opinion. But so anyway, you always wonder about, you know, what's really going on here. But an interesting policy issue about whether or not, you know, should, going back to my point from the last case about this, how the system works, you get a decision, and then if you don't like it, you can change the statute. You know, would be an interesting debate to hear on both sides of this, whether we should be requiring records to be produced electronically, because it certainly lowers the burden on the requester, but it potentially opens, you know, record keepers up to frivolous requests for a lot of records. if the party's not going to have to pay to have them copied, and they have to come inspect them, and they just, you know, want to fire off requests. So there's some balancing to be done there. Interesting issue.
More appropriate for the legislature.
Yeah, they need to
decide, right?
They need to do a study, a legislative study, that these studies that they do between sessions.
Any listeners who might have any information on this, please feel free to email us about whether this is a discussion being had at the legislature or not.
Next case, Deutsche Bank National Trust Company versus Rice, 2021 OK Civ App 21. Despite the trust name in the title, it's not another trust case. I'm sorry. This is actually a mortgage foreclosure case. So this case comes up from Oklahoma County, where at trial it was presided over by now Court of Civil Appeals Judge Prince, and his colleagues affirm him. I'm get cut right to the end here. His new colleagues at the Court of Civil Appeals affirm his trial court ruling. So it's assigned to Division II, and the facts are that the bank, Deutsche Bank, that's German, Jana, Deutsche Bank sued a borrower, Rice, for default and foreclosed a mortgage. And the borrower, Rice, defended the foreclosure and basically said, "You did bad first, bank. You breached the note and mortgage contract before I did, because you failed to make the property insurance payment from escrow. And I lost my, and then the property became uninsured for some period of time. And that happened before I defaulted. So I'm excused from my default because, you know, you did it first." It doesn't work. the trial court says, no, the bank's entitled to foreclosure. Their summary judgment motion is granted. The borrower was in default on the note. The bank is entitled to foreclose their mortgage. Borrower appeals again, saying, "Hey, wait, you know, the bank breached first, so they shouldn't be able to foreclose on me." And the Court of Civil Appeals says, "Yeah, it's true. Mortgage foreclosure is an equitable proceeding, and it's possible that the court could refuse to accelerate a note and allow foreclosure on equitable grounds. But that power should be used very sparingly. And there's nothing in this case that makes us think it's would have been appropriate to, on equitable grounds, stop the bank from foreclosing." What happened is, as everyone will probably be familiar with from your own personal experience, every time you make your mortgage payment, like on your house, for example, a part of that payment is actually for the property insurance and taxes. And the bank holds that amount in escrow until the property insurance payments due, and then they make the payment, because the bank is incentivized to make sure the property stays insured and doesn't get sold at a tax sale. So they want to be the ones to handle the payment to the insurer and the county for the taxes. So every payment you make has a little bit of money in there for those costs, and the bank holds that in escrow until those payments are due and then makes those on your behalf. Well, in this case, because of an internal error at the bank, they stopped payment on the check for the insurance, this check they issued, and then they stopped payment on it because of some internal policy issue. And so the insurance policy lapsed, but the bank corrected the error. They purchased another insurance policy. So while the property was insured for some period of time, there's no evidence in the record that the borrower was caused any damage or harm because of that. So the Court of Civil Appeals says there's nothing in the record that shows the bank's failure to timely pay the insurance premium caused the borrower any damage or was in any way related to why the borrower stopped making their payments. So sorry, borrower. Affirmed. Presiding Judge Barnes authors. Judges Rapp and Fisher concur. The borrower petitions for cert and is denied 8-0.
Yeah. Okay. Creative argument, at least. But yeah, no, didn't have anything to do with.
Yeah, I'd say that would be the category of like a hyper technical legal argument, like you know, like a gotcha type of thing, like but you breached first, so even though I was caused no harm and your breach had nothing to do with my breach, you know, you're going to lose your mortgage.
All right. Well, up next we've got a retaliatory discharge claim. So 2021 OK Civ App 22, Mitchell versus City of Okmulgee. This one involves a fire chief for the City of Okmulgee who was injured on the job in October.
Apparently, firefighting is dangerous work. This is our second case with an injured firefighter.
Yep. Well, and this is, although it's the issue in this case is not what was decided in the earlier opinion you discussed, it was a part of why this retaliatory discharge claim was filed. So he's injured on the job in October 2013, and he files a workers' comp claim, and he starts receiving his TTD payments. And under the statute, as opposed to the collective bargaining agreement in the other case, he does continue to receive his full salary and benefit, and in exchange assigned part of his TTD benefits to the city. So he's getting paid this whole time. And so the city, after 12 months, the city sends him a letter that says that his 12 months of paid injury leave is about to expire, but that the medical records that he's submitted to the city indicate that he can't really return to work. And so the letter from the city advises him that because he had declined any alternative position, the city had no choice but to terminate him. So after he's terminated, he files this action in the district court for retaliatory discharge and due process violations. On summary judgment, the trial court grants judgment in favor of the fire chief and entered a damages award for $120,000 against the city. So the city appeals, and this is assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals Division 2. And in an opinion from Judge Mitchell, we get a reversal here, and the case is remanded for further proceedings. So what the Court of Civil Appeals holds here in this case is that Title 11, Section 4911, which is the statute that gave him his full pay and benefits while he was under temporary disability, says that it applies notwithstanding the workers' compensation provisions of Title 85 related to TTD benefits. As such, the workers' compensation statute that prohibited discharging an employee during his TTD period did not apply. And so the trial court should not have granted judgment in favor of the fire chief on the retaliatory discharge claim. And the Court of Civil Appeals also says that we don't see any kind of a due process violation here because the city provided a sufficient cause for termination and provided the fire chief with a written notice. And that notice specifically advised him that if he disagreed with the city's interpretation or conclusions about his medical ability to do his job, he could provide updated information, which he did not do. The fire chief petitioned for cert, and in a written dissent, Justice Gurich says whether Title 11, Section 4911 renders this provision in Title 85 inapplicable is an issue of first impression that the court should address. So, did not get the votes to take cert, and the case is headed back.
Okay. What are they going to do on remand?
Well, I think they said that they specifically say in this case, although the city asks us to direct the trial court to enter judgment in its favor, the denial of its motion for summary judgment is not reviewable on appeal. So sometimes I don't know. It's an interesting procedural.
Yeah. Instead of reversing it and directing them to enter judgment for the city, they just basically said, well, the summary judgment motion was denied. You're back to where you were before that. I guess the city must have not had a counter summary judgment motion.
And if they did, they didn't appeal it. So
interesting. Okay. Well, next I'm going to knock out two birds with one stone because there are actually two published opinions coming out of the same case. They're companion cases about slightly different issues, but they resulted in two opinions. 2021 OK CIVAP 23 and 2021 OK CIVAP 27 are both Suburban Realty Company versus Cantley. And this is a deed reformation case and a statute of limitations issue. You may recall some listeners who practice in the real estate area, the 2016 case from the Oklahoma Supreme Court, Calvert v. Swinford, where the court said the statute of limitations for reforming a deed starts to run when the deed is filed. Since then, there have been a number of cases who have clawed back at that. Yes,
did they?
Lots of exceptions.
That's what I was proposing.
Yes, sort of. Calvert v. Swinford has never been expressly overruled, but there have certainly been some exceptions carved out.
Well, and some of them too, unpublished opinions from the Court of Civil Appeals, which we don't report on, obviously, and which are not necessarily supposed to be
cited. It has been pointed out by a judge of the Court of Civil Appeals, but they work just as hard on the unpublished cases as the published
ones.
That's
right.
Which I'm sure is true.
Look, we've made it pretty clear on our stump list issues here that we like unpublished Court of Civil Appeals opinions just as much as we like published ones. But until the court changes the rule, that's what the rule says. So nevertheless, there are several unpublished Court of Civil Appeals decisions and now a published one that have clawed back at
yes.
Calvert.
So what do we have here? We have an owner of a lot in a development who has a contract to sell this lot for $1 million for commercial use. And during title examination, a title requirement was made to address some language in the deed of dedication of the plat, which was filed in 1989. And the language in the plat dedication deed says no lot shall be used for commercial or professional purposes of any kind or for any commercial or manufacturing purpose. So problem. We have a commercial piece of property that has a restriction in the plat that says it can't be used for business or professional purpose or any commercial or manufacturing purpose. So the owner of said lot files suit in Tulsa County seeking to reform the 1989 deed of dedication of the Country Crossings plat to the city of Bixby to fix what the owner says was clearly a mistake in this language. So the trial court agrees and says this was a mistake and it needs to be fixed. And the trial court reforms that language that I quoted a moment ago to add the word residential before lot. So now it says no residential lot shall be used for business or professional or commercial or manufacturing purposes of any kind. Well, some of the other owners in the Country Crossings edition have appealed that decision, and it gets assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals, Division 2. Division 2 was very prolific recently. A lot of published opinions. So the court kind of goes through the history of this piece of property, and they say that, well, originally the developers of this addition filed a plat in 1966 that identified this lot that's at issue in this case as a commercial lot, that it was otherwise a residential development, but there is this one lot that is on the edge of the development that is bordered by two arterial streets that is commercial, and it is zoned commercial, and the plat identifies it in 1966 as being for commercial shopping. Then in 1989, the
question.
Yes.
Was there a deed, a dedication deed originally filed in 1966 also, or was it just the plat?
I believe it was both. Yes, there was a plat and a deed of dedication.
And so that deed was the deed that they were reforming, or was there another deed in 89?
There's another deed in 89, and that's what they're trying to reform. Because in 89, the area was replatted. So it's kind of a do-over, you know, a replat, and kind of in trust world, you would call it like a restatement and complete amendment and complete restatement. So you don't change the name of the trust, but this is a whole new trust. Well, they did change the name of the development, I think, in this one too. But so 89, they come in and they replat the whole thing. And the new plat is called Country Crossings, and it maintains this lot 1, block 9, which is just under 2 acres. It's the exact same lot as was included in the original 1966 plat. And it, again, shows it as commercial shopping in 1989. And it's in 1989 that the deed of dedication of Country Crossings edition has this language that says no lot shall be used. So that language wasn't in the original 1966 plat or deed of dedication. It just first appears in during the replat in 1989.
Interesting.
Also of importance is that lot 1, block 9 has been used for commercial purposes all along. It's a vacant lot, but they had a fireworks stand on it at various times, you know, and at one time the owner had a very large sign on the property for sale and promoted its commercial zoning. And as I mentioned, it has been zoned commercial, apparently all the way back to 1966 or before. And there's been no action brought by any of the defendants in the case or the appellants on appeal all these years to try to stop the fireworks stand, or they didn't, you know, bring some action when the for sale sign was up advertising it as commercial property. So that's the historical background here. And again, the trial court found that this was clearly a mistake in this 1989 deed of dedication and reformed the deed of dedication to insert the word residential before a lot, so that no residential lot in Crossings, Country Crossings edition shall be used for commercial purposes. And that would preserve lot 1, block 9's commercial status. The Court of Civil Appeals says this is kind of a mixed question of law and fact. An action to reform a deed is equitable, and we won't disturb the judgment of the trial court against its unless it's against a clear weight of the evidence or clearly contrary to law or established principles of equity. However, you know, how we get to reformation is we have to find some ambiguity, and that's a question of law as to whether or not an ambiguity exists. And do we review questions of law, de novo, and also statute of limitations issues are ordinarily reviewed as questions of law. So it's kind of a mixed review. And they say that there is an ambiguity because the deed of dedication and the plat and the zoning, they contradict one another. So that creates an ambiguity. So that opens the door to extrinsic evidence of intent and mistake. And they affirm the trial court. They say that there was a mistake and we're going to reform it. The trial court was correct to reform it. And with respect to the issue of statute of limitations, which is probably the most important part of the whole case for sure, because this deed of dedication that they're seeking to reform had been filed in 1989. So about 30 plus years that this has been of public record before this action is brought to reform the deed. And the trial court did not think that barred the plaintiff's action, and the Court of Civil Appeals agrees. And they point to a 1938 Oklahoma Supreme Court case called Hoskins v. Stites that says that the statute of limitations cannot be pleaded as a defense to an action for reformation of a deed for mistake if the party proceeding, that would be the plaintiff in this case, proceeding to have the deed reformed, has been in continual, peaceable, and uninterrupted possession of the premises since the time of execution of the instrument. The statute of limitations is no defense to an action by a grantee in possession of real estate to have his deed reformed before his possession is disputed. So they say that is a case is still good law, that Calvert v. Swinford didn't repeal it, and it fits the facts of this case. So they survived the statute of limitations and get their deed reformed. They also say that the appellant's latches claim fails because the fact that the plaintiffs waited so long to bring up this mistake or error in the deed of dedication was contributed to because the defendants slash appellants delayed seeking enforcement of this restriction, even though the property was being used for commercial purposes and had been openly advertised as commercial property.
Okay, this is an interesting one.
Affirmed.
I'd like to point out two things when you, sorry, yep. Affirmed. Sorry.
Affirmed, authored by Judge Wiseman, Judge Barnes, and Judge Hickson, sitting by designation, concur. Now, we don't, unfortunately, get to get this up to the court, the Supreme Court, to see what they think about this vis-a-vis their 2016 Calvert opinion, because after the opinion is issued, before the 30-day deadline to seek rehearing or cert, the parties file
20 days. 20. Sorry.
Oh, thank you for correcting me. Yeah. So during that time, the
although
parties,
we don't give legal advice on this show, but nevertheless.
Well, yeah. That's debatable, but okay. The parties filed joint advice to the court, advising them that the case has been settled and that they are ready for mandate. So,
okay.
Perhaps the plaintiff was scared about mandate or was scared about cert. Yeah.
Cert, that's true. Two things I think are interesting to point out about the analysis of the Court of Civil Appeals in this opinion. So the first thing, they directly address Calvert in paragraph 26. And Judge Wiseman in that paragraph says, in Calvert, what Calvert is typically cited for is that the statute of limitations begins to run when the deed is filed of record. So obviously 1989. You know, that's when the homeowners in this case are saying that the statute should have started running. Judge Wiseman says in Calvert, the plaintiffs executed and delivered a deed in that case, which did not reserve a mineral interest, as was provided in the sales contract. And they sued the entity handling the closing of the transaction for negligence, but filed the action after the negligence limitation period expired. The action in Calvert did not seek reformation, and plaintiffs had not been in possession of the claimed mineral interest. Calvert does not apply here. Interesting distinction, I think, from the Court of Civil Appeals here. The other thing I think that is interesting about their analysis is they specifically look at the plat and the deed. So correct me if I'm wrong here, because you know more about this than I do. But two separately filed documents of record?
I think they were in this case.
Maybe?
Yeah. It's
okay. Are they always or?
Usually what they're calling the deed of dedication, I think would more commonly be the covenants and restrictions.
Okay.
Now you can include covenants and restrictions on the plat itself, and sometimes you'll see those, but for more contemporary development, you usually will see a plat and then a separately filed document that is the covenants and restrictions applicable to the plat. Yeah.
So interestingly, then in paragraph 18, they say if the two documents are viewed independently, the ambiguity is latent, but it becomes apparent when they're considered together in light of the transaction involved here. I think that's an interesting analysis, because typically you want to look at the document filed of record. Not that you want to look at it. Typically, I would say you look at the document filed of record to determine whether within the four corners of that document is there an ambiguity. But they are looking at the rest of the things around it filed to come up with the ambiguity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the plat says it's commercial. And then you have the deed of dedication or the covenants that say nothing on this plat shall be used for commercial. So you've got a conflict between the two.
True.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I'm just pointing out that I think that's an interesting analysis, and
it's one of those
distinction of Calvert.
Where you're going to look at allied papers, like the allied papers, like sometimes in estate planning, probate, trust, construction cases, they kind of do the same thing. You got to look at this plan as a whole, not in a silo.
To determine the intent.
Right.
All right. There you go, listeners.
So now I have to close the loop, though, on the companion case.
Not quite as interesting, right? Attorney's fees.
Actually, not at all. I mean, pretty interesting if you're one of the attorneys, but not doesn't have broad implications and kind of surprised that they published it, really. After prevailing at the trial court on their action to reform the deed of dedication based on mistake, the plaintiff then applies to assess attorney's fees and costs on the defendants under 60 OS 2011, Section 856, which is a statute that says fees and costs may be awarded to the prevailing party in an action to enforce a restriction or covenant of real estate development. And the trial court says, no, this is not an action to enforce a restriction or a covenant of real estate. You're asking me to reform a restriction or covenant of real estate. And the Court of Civil Appeals agrees. So they affirm, same author, Judge Wiseman, same panel, same result.
Okay. Interesting case there, folks. All right. Next up, 2021 OK Civ App 24. In this case, this is Pendergraft versus Brooks. I don't know for sure what about this case was worthy of publication, but nevertheless,
quotas.
It is published.
Quotas.
What's that?
Quotas. They have a quota how many cases they need to publish every term. So,
no, right.
I'm just kidding. I don't know that. Can neither confirm nor deny that. It's just pure speculation.
Yeah. So the underlying dispute was about settlement of the plaintiff's tort claim against the defendant. I think it was some kind of an automobile accident. So the parties go to a court-ordered mediation, and the terms of the settlement that they reached at the mediation were documented in a notice of settlement, and it was signed by the parties and the mediator. There were a couple of handwritten insertions on the settlement agreement, but all parties initialed it. And so, of course,
you get done with the mediation, and now the plaintiff is refusing to honor the agreement. And so the defendant in this case files a motion to enforce the settlement agreement, and the district court grants the motion and enters judgment in favor of the defendant, finding that the parties had entered into a valid and enforceable settlement agreement. One of the terms of the settlement agreement provided that the plaintiff would dismiss his case against the defendant in exchange for payment of the agreed settlement amount. So the defendant pays the money into the court clerk's office settlement amount and notifies the district court after the court has entered the order enforcing the settlement agreement. She notifies the district court that she's paid the money, and so the court enters an order dismissing the case with prejudice. So procedurally, maybe this is why it was published, I'm not sure. Procedurally, then the plaintiff appeals the court's order dismissing the case with prejudice, as opposed to the court's order granting the defendant's motion to enforce the settlement agreement. So a lot of this opinion talks about what the court can and cannot review from the dismissal of prejudice. So a lot of the arguments in the plaintiff's appellate briefing go to the merits of whether the settlement agreement should have been enforced. And so the Court of Civil Appeals says that order wasn't appealed, so it's beyond review of this appellate court. The only order subject to review was the court's order dismissing the case with prejudice. And what all that order did was effectuate one of the, you know, things that needed to happen in the settlement agreement. And so we don't see any abuse of discretion here by the trial judge in dismissing the case. The court did note that several of the issues that were brought up in the appeal that related to the merits of whether the settlement should have been enforced could be remedied in a subsequent breach of contract action if the plaintiff truly believed that the defendant was in breach of the agreement. So there were some issues about whether defendant's counsel was to send a letter to plaintiff's insurer and who was going to be negotiating with the plaintiff's medical insurer on some of these sort of collateral issues of payment. So it's affirmed, and this was written by Judge Fisher. So that's it.
Okay, well, put a pin in, we can't go back and review a prior order. Just put a pin in that.
Okay.
Get right back to you. So that's Division One making that assertion. Okay. 2021 OK Civ App 25. This is Burleson v. Wayne. This is a case that was decided by the Court of Civil Appeals Division 4, coming up on appeal from the District Court of Oklahoma County. Division 4. Okay. Keep that in mind. In this medical negligence
case. Like we all know where this is going.
Yeah. In this medical negligence case, the injured party, the plaintiff, was undergoing surgery to repair her nasal septum. That's some kind of a nose thing, right? 2 days following surgery, one of her breast implants deflates. Now, When repairing a nasal septum, it is apparently necessary to harvest cartilage from the rib, which you don't have to go to medical school to be familiar enough with anatomy to know that the deflated breast implant is in the general vicinity of the rib. So that's the connection here. So plaintiff brings lawsuit, sues doctor, and is awarded partial summary judgment on the issue of liability based on a res ipsa loquitur pattern of proof. So taking us back to law school.
The thing speaks for itself.
That's
folks.
Right. Exactly. If a breast implant deflates, there has obviously been a problem. A mistake was made. Well, you're right. The thing speaks for itself. To take advantage of the res ipsa, gosh, you're going to really challenge my Latin today in this one.
Res ipsa loquitur.
There you go. What she said. She's from Minco. I'm from El Reno. You know, to expect us to to speak Latin is
that's right.
probably a bridge too far. Well, to take advantage of this funny Latin phrase, the plaintiff would need to show that there's an injury, that the injury was proximately caused by some instrumentality within the sole control of the defendant, and that ordinarily, absent some negligence on the part of that defendant, this injury would not occur. So that's what is necessary to use that pattern of proof. And the trial court grants summary judgment to the plaintiff on the issue of liability on this res ipsa theory. Well, the defendant, we get to trial because we haven't established damages yet. We get to trial, and the defendant asks the court to review the prior grant of partial summary judgment on liability and allow the defendant to present evidence to the jury on this issue of liability. The trial court denies. The case goes to the jury on damages, and they award $125,000 to the plaintiff. Now, the trial court actually certified the order denying, I'm not entirely sure. Let me see if I have it in my notes.
Partial grant of summary judgment,
yeah,
probably.
I think that's right. I think the trial court certified the partially granted summary judgment motion for interlocutory appeal. Makes sense. You know, before we take a jury and go through all the damages, let's find out if I'm right on the liability issue. But the Supreme Court doesn't take it. They decline review. So go back and we have a trial on damages. And then after the trial on damages, the defendant appeals the case, the liability, to the Supreme Court, and they assign it to Court of Civil Appeals Division 4. Court of Civil Appeals Division 4, standard of review, they make note that when reviewing a judgment, the court may reverse, vacate, or modify any anterior intermediate order involving the merits of the action or any portion thereof. An immediately appealable by right interlocutory order which is not appealed, or a non-appealable uncertified interlocutory order, may thus be subject to appellate review on appeal from the subsequent judgment. Seems different than what Division I was saying in the last case you just talked about.
I don't think it's different. I think because this is summary judgment, it makes it. Because it's summary judgment, I think there's a distinction from the previous case.
Okay.
So, and also because it was a partial grant of summary judgment. And even though the court certified that order, that appeal was a discretionary review from the Supreme Court, meaning it went up on a cert petition. So, yes, you can wait to have that summary judgment issue reviewed until the end of the case.
Okay.
Partial grant of summary judgment can be reviewed at the end as opposed to the last case, which that order imposing the settlement agreement would have been a final appealable order that they needed to take up, whereas this one is not in and of itself a final appealable order.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. So the court is reviewing a partial summary judgment motion. So, of course, we know that's going to be de novo with the evidence and the inferences drawn therefrom viewed in light most favorable to the non-moving party. And the Court of Civil Appeals says, look, there was no expert testimony offered by the plaintiff in support of her partial summary judgment motion. In fact, the plaintiff's own expert in deposition said some things that would suggest, even when reasonable care is taken, a breast implant can be deflated during a procedure to harvest rib cartilage. So the court says, even if we assume that the implant was deflated during the surgery, which, remember, it didn't show up as deflated until 2 days after the surgery. But even if we assume that it was deflated during the surgery, the plaintiff still has to present some evidentiary materials to support all the elements of a negligence claim. And that is normally done by expert testimony, and there wasn't any. And the plaintiff has the burden of proving that the applicable standard of care was breached and that that breach resulted in the harm to the plaintiff. There was also some evidence that the plaintiff's surgeon, who had done the breast implant surgery, had contacted the plaintiff sometime before the procedure where the rib cartilage was harvested to schedule replacement of the breast implants. And there was some evidence that breast implants, as they age, can spontaneously deflate. So the court reverses and remands this one back to the trial court and says, you know, the plaintiff did not establish through expert testimony that the defendant breached his duty of care or caused her injury, and most certainly should not have been granted summary judgment on that issue.
Okay, so it's going back and she's got to show, I mean, they basically have to go to trial then on the causation issue, right?
Correct. Liability and causation. You could prove causation, but you still have to also show that the doctor breached the applicable standard of care. You could cause the injury and still, as long as you're exercising standard of care, then you're still not liable.
I see. Okay.
It's not strict liability for deflating a breast implant.
Well, maybe it should be.
Again, you know, the way the system works, cases come out and then the legislature can pass statutes. So if they want to pass a statute imposing strict liability on the deflator of a breast implant, then that is
within their policy. Purview.
Yes. Yep.
Police power to do so.
I think so.
This is a very difficult case to talk about without making a lot of inappropriate jokes, we should note. So
admirable job of that. Anybody that was hoping for an inappropriate joke, I hope we did, you know, let the air out of your balloon.
Okay. The last case, are we on the last case now?
Yes,
because you did 27.
Yeah.
This is 2021 OK CivApp 26, Truitt versus Freedom Leaf. So there's not a lot of case law published opinions on appointment of a receiver. And so that's what this case involves. And it's first published case involving an appointment, published opinion from an appellate court involving the appointment of a receiver to take over a medical marijuana dispensary. So if this is your practice area, if you've been working in the medical marijuana area, this is probably one that you want to take a look at. So this comes up from Stevens County, and the underlying facts are that the plaintiff and defendant owned this dispensary together, and plaintiff filed suit against the defendant seeking an accounting of the dispensary finances and also made an allegation of breach of fiduciary duty for mismanagement of company assets. What I think this case is important for is that here the plaintiff also sought an emergency order appointing a receiver to manage the affairs of the dispensary, and the trial court granted that request. I mean, this was before the lawsuit had been served on the defendant, and so I think the order was entered in this case on like a Friday, the emergency order appointing the receiver. The receiver and his employees show up on that Friday evening with the order and take over operations. So by Monday, of course, the defendant has started filing things, trying to figure out what's going on. And one of the things that ends up being filed is a motion to vacate the order appointing the receiver. So the trial court holds a hearing on the motion and denies the motion to vacate the emergency order appointing the receiver, and the defendant appeals. So this goes up and is assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals Division 1. And standard of review cited here is abuse of discretion. And the court here does find that the trial court abused its discretion in not vacating the emergency order appointing the receiver. And so there's a couple of interesting things here that come from this opinion that I think if you're practicing in this area, you'll want to take a look at. So they do not reverse the case because the order was done in an emergency fashion. So paragraph 11 is specifically where they talk about this. A trial court's decision to appoint a receiver is within its discretion. And on an emergency basis, we are going to give the trial court quite a bit of deference with regard to issuing this order ex parte lack of notice. Okay, so
Then, though, they go to the next argument, which is the insufficient evidence and insufficient inquiry allegations that were brought up on appeal. And so they find here that the court did err when it denied the motion to vacate because it abused its discretion and did not take proper evidence on the qualifications of the receiver and did not really dig into the evidence that the initial emergency order was based on. So what I think is interesting about this opinion is that is paragraph 17, the court points out that there's no evidence in the record that this particular receiver that was appointed had complied with any of the requirements in Title 63 dealing with the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority and who can operate dispensaries. And so there was nothing in the record that showed that this receiver was registered with the State Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Control System. And so the Court of Civil Appeals says it looks to us like they, you know, appointing this particular receiver may have put the dispensary in non-compliance with the OMMA requirements. So again, this is the first one of its kind from an appellate court of our state. And so I think if you're a trial judge and you get a request like this, this will be an important opinion for you to take a look at and see if there's any guidance here and that can help you in making sure you're looking at all of the correct things in appointing a receiver.
Certainly have some
reversed.
I certainly have some empathy for trial judges when lawyers show up with ex parte emergency orders, appointment, the receiver, restraining orders, injunctions. I mean, they are definitely kind of put on the spot and, you know, they only get to hear one side of the story and
for sure
have to, you know, sit through the parade of horribles of what's going to happen if they don't grant this. And so.
Right. And especially in this area, this is not the OMMA regulations and some of the statutes that go along with all this. These are not easy to navigate. And I'm not sure that, and this is just my editorial comment, I'm not sure that all of the possible repercussions have been thought through with regard to how to get a receiver appointed in a case like this. So,
yeah, anyways, I mean, it seems to raise
for those of you out there interested in making some law, there you go.
And it seems to raise an issue in many other regulated industries, like the receiver has to be licensed to operate in that particular industry. I mean, if I get appointed the receiver of a hair salon, do I have to hold a cosmetology license?
Interesting point. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just being silly, but I mean that.
No, yeah.
Well, so no cert sought or cert denied or.
No cert was sought in this case. And I did not go and pull the documents, but there was a motion for attorney's fees and costs filed by the dispensary in this case that the appellate court denied. So.
Okay.
Mandate was issued and that's it. So no discussion from the Supreme Court on this issue yet.
What do you think about when citing published Court of Civil Appeals opinions? Is it your practice to parenthetically note whether there was cert denied or not sought? Or
I don't typically note that. Unless there is some kind of a written dissent to cert that would bring up, you know, that brings up some interesting issues about the case. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, the idea is that just because they denied cert doesn't mean they've addressed anything with regard to the merits of the case. So, but, you know, if it's a 5-4 decision on the denial of cert and there's a written dissent, you know, that's got the arguments that you're putting forth, I think that's something to note at least. So,
right.
But yeah. I don't typically note it.
A trial judge, maybe if you're asking them to go against a Court of Civil Appeals published opinion, then they may feel better about that if you show them that you know, either cert was not sought, or if it was sought and denied, it was close. And that was a while ago, and it may come out differently this time, since we know that the Court of Civil Appeals opinions are persuasive only anyway, except, I guess, potentially binding against the same division.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, so what if you're the party? I mean, it's just the luck of the draw, which we're going to, what panel you're going to get. So, okay. Well, that was an action-packed and very long episode, but that perhaps one of the things we may think about during our time off from the podcast this summer is whether we want to try to do more frequent and shorter updates, because these get pretty long when you wait, you know, to do half of the cases.
It's true.
From the first 6 months of the year in one episode.
Mm-hmm.
Something to think about. I guess, you know, listeners probably, if they want to listen to the whole thing, it's not as if you have to sit down and listen to it all at once. So I can't imagine anybody would do that.
Okay.
That's true. Any closing comments, thoughts?
No, I don't think so.
Anything you want to put out there into the world before we take our summer break?
I don't think so. We're looking forward to coming back with another season and are brainstorming now what direction to take starting again in September. So if anybody has any ideas or any guests that they would like to see or hear from, shoot us an email over on our website, oklahomaappeals.com.
Okay, well, have a good summer, everybody. And we'll talk again here in a couple months. Bye-bye. Hi, everyone. This is Gabe again. To find show notes, contact the host, and more, go to oklahomaappeals.com. Also, if you're interested in the things we cover on this show, then you should follow us on Twitter at Oklahoma Appeals, where we post court news and other items of interest for Oklahoma lawyers. Okay, Jana and I will be back with a new episode every other Wednesday. So until next time, bye-bye.